Welcome to Boating Insights. This is a podcast about achieving your boating dreams, brought to you by Above and Beyond Boating. We deliver the leading courses to skipper your own boat.
Okay, hi there. Welcome back to Boating Insights. My name is Neil Driscoll. I'm very lucky to be joined today by Linda Berryman of the Australian Maritime Safety Authority, AMSA. Linda, thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Neil. Thank you for the opportunity.
No worries. Now, could you just, we're going to talk all things beacons and EPIRBs and PLBs, but could you just give us a quick snapshot for the listeners in case they're not familiar. Who are AMSA from a search and rescue perspective, and what is it that you do at AMSA?
Sure. So AMSA provides a search and rescue, or otherwise known as a SAR service for Australia. This allows us to quickly deploy a SAR response for anyone in distress. And Australia has established a cooperative SAR arrangement between AMSA, the State and Territory Police, and the Australian Defence Force. My role at AMSA involves providing specialist advice on distress alerting, communication and safety systems, of which I have over 20 years' experience. And in particular, this includes distress beacons and MMSIs, in which we will discuss today.
Brilliant. Thank you. Now, just for the listeners here, when we're talking beacons, we're essentially talking about personal locator beacons, or PLBs, or EPIRBs. The concept being, you know, an EPIRB in this case for a vessel, and a PLB, so personal locator beacon, so it's for a person. There are some kind of fundamental differences between the two. We're really looking at that being assumed knowledge, and we're going to get into sort of some of the nuances of features that you might have on a beacon and how they're registered and how they work and that sort of thing for you today. So I think most people, when you're listening, have got some assumed knowledge. Now, first of all, Linda, do you need a marine radio license to register a beacon, PLB, EPIRB, etc.?
No, you don't actually require a marine radio license to register a beacon.
Okay. And so one of the questions I get asked a lot is, because when you're filling out the registration form, it has an option of the MMSI number. So, and people then go, I don't have a marine radio license. I've got to get my MMSI number, and then I'll register my beacon once I've got this all done. And I'm always trying to encourage them, no, don't wait, because it can take time to get a radio license and things. Just get your beacon registered straight away as soon as you have one and you've got the vessel. So is it right that it's just not a required field? It's just that if you're essentially, if you've got an MMSI number and you're registering a beacon, people have got the option to let you know what their MMSI number is. Is that why it's sort of on the application form, or an option that they can fill in?
It's essentially there for two reasons. One is to help us validate and cross-reference and locate your potential existing account, so we can add the information to your account. Or alternatively, sometimes it may identify that there's been a change of ownership of the MMSI, and then subsequently we need to provide further guidance in transferring the MMSI registration.
Awesome, thank you. But in absolute summary, if you've got a beacon, register it. Don't wait to organise a radio license. Just get it registered and make sure your details are up to date.
That's right.
Thank you. Now, can beacons that are bought outside of Australia be registered with AMSA?
Sure. So 406 distress beacons, they really need to be compliant with the Australian New Zealand standard. And the Australian New Zealand standard for EPIRBs is 4280.1, and the PLB standard is 4280.2. And they need to be programmed with the Australian Country Code 503 in order to be registered in Australia. If the beacon is programmed with a foreign country code, so you've purchased it from overseas, you can contact the beacon manufacturer, refer to their user manual or website for guidance and contact details as to where the beacon can be returned for servicing and the costs associated. You may like to consider the battery expiry date and compare the cost to that of purchasing a new beacon, which may have more advanced functionality such as GPS, return link service, or AIS.
Fantastic. Thank you. Now, what are the advances with PLBs and beacons with AIS coming out at the moment? And so Can you just sort of explain? I know there's been some kind of groundbreaking developments from before we started. We were talking about it being a lifetime work and something that you've worked on for nearly 20 years, and I've been monitoring for about the same amount of time. Can you just explain some of the sort of advances of beacons and AIS and what's going on and some of the new functionality with Return Link Service and so on?
Sure. So it's actually quite exciting, the new advancements in technology around the 406 megahertz distress beacons. So the new AIS, EPIRBs and PLBs, they allow AIS equipped vessels within VHF range to be alerted of the beacon activation and potential capability to then react and affect the rescue. The AIS equipped EPIRBs and PLBs, they will transmit on 406 megahertz frequency, which is the hex ID that's detected by the COSPAS SARSAT system and received by the Rescue Coordination Centre. In addition, the 121.5 megahertz frequency, that's the International Aviation Distress Frequency, so aircraft monitor and notify air traffic control, and the new AIS, and that's transmitting as an AIS user ID. That is pre-programmed into the beacon with a 9-digit character, which is similar format as an MMSI. But this AIS user ID is not to be programmed or confused to be programmed into your VHF, HF or AIS fixed mounted equipment on your vessel. And the AIS user ID can be received by vessels within VHF range. The AIS symbol displayed on the AIS receiver will be presented as a circle with a red cross. That's the same symbol that's displayed for an AIS EPIRB, an AIS SART, which is associated to a life raft or tender, an AIS man overboard or AIS PLB. You need to read the text associated to the symbol to identify the device transmitting. So this assists in identifying what to visually look for, such as a vessel, life raft, or person. The 1 to 1.5 megahertz and AIS transmissions will interleave. The PLB AIS user ID will be in the format commencing of a 9-digit number commencing with 972, and the EPIRB AIS user ID will commence with 974. The EPIRB and PLB 15-character hex ID will also broadcast over AIS as a message 14 safety-related broadcast message to tie the identities together. Some EPIRBs or PLBs may also have the new Return Link Service as a function. RLS is the acronym used. So RLS-enabled beacons can receive an automatic acknowledgement that their 406 megahertz distress alert and location has been received. When the RLS-enabled beacon receives the return link message, or an RLM, it provides the beacon user with reassurance the distress alert has been received, and that can be displayed as either a flashing blue light or text display. However, please note, this does not mean that a rescue has been coordinated or launched, so be prepared to survive. The time it takes for search and rescue personnel to reach you depends on a number of factors, including the weather, terrain, and accessibility of your location. The more remote the location of the distress incident, the longer the response time.
Brilliant, thank you. And so the sort of, for me, the big headline with this, and really useful for the detail of how these things work, is that there's been, for a fair while now, we've had the option, let's just look on the AIS for a moment, that you could have the beacons, like a personal locator beacon that someone could activate. Let's say they've fallen overboard, they turn that on, and they can send a signal that's received by satellite. And in, you know, the case of Australian registration, it will make it back to you guys, and you can coordinate a search and rescue. But the problem was that they then needed a separate beacon if they wanted to, which transmitted AIS, which they would need to also carry and activate, so that the vessel could use that to try and find them if they've lost sort of visual contact and they're trying to implement a search. So you did have two beacons. And the AIS could be set up historically, could be automatic to turn on when the life jacket activated, but the PLB was always manual. And now we've got a scenario that's literally just occurred where they've managed to create beacons which have met the relevant standards in Australia and New Zealand, so, and other parts of the world, we're just focusing on locally, which is in one beacon, so, and can be set up so it can turn on, especially for these PLBs with AIS. So when the life jacket activates, the beacon turns on, you're still sending a message via satellite to the Rescue Coordination Centre, but you're also able to send out a signal that can be received by any vessels with AIS receiving functionality in your area, so that you're just hopefully increasing the chances of being found exponentially. And in the event that you were unable to activate your beacon for any number of reasons, as long as it was set up correctly and you were wearing the life jacket that it was set up inside, it could have activated for you, removing the need for you to have had to do that if for some reason you were unable to. Have I kind of summarized that right from a PLB perspective, Linda?
Yeah, it's fantastic. We've now got a 406 megahertz distress beacon combined with the man overboard AIS device. So it's a 2-in-1 now.
That's kind of the game changer for me. I mean, the EPIRBS as well, that's massive, great. I think that kind of went without saying, didn't it? But when I used to be explaining this for people in, you know, a sea survival radio course context, for, and then they were like, so the PLB, can that be automatically activated? And you're like, no. Oh, okay. And can the AIS and the PLB be one unit? No. So the idea that this can now be automatic and it's just one unit, because the life, yeah, aside from costs, it's the life jacket gets very busy and heavy with the more things that you're putting into it, and it's just more stuff to remember to turn on and activate. So this is, to me, it's one of the biggest game changers in terms of technology for marine safety to reach the recreational market in probably my career, I would say, actually, so far. It's huge, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the first advancement with the 406 distress beacons since its first deployment back in the late 80s. So, you know, we're talking about 20, 30 years. So yeah, it's a significant improvement.
Yeah, it's really exciting. And and you can see that the devices, we'll have a link in the show notes, but the AMSA website has the beacons. There's definitely, for example, ACR and also Ocean Signal have got beacons, EPIRBS and PLBs that have got AIS currently recognized in them. But you can also monitor that website. So if other manufacturers end up releasing compliant units, then you'll be able to see them. If you're listening to this outside of Australia and New Zealand, you just need to check for your local area, wherever you'll be registering it, that this has also kind of, that it's something that you can register and it's compliant for your local region. It's fast moving technology, but I think you just can't yet 100% assume, but over a very short period of time, you'll find that these are something that you can use and register pretty much all over the world. Now, let's just go on to PLBs for a second. So if a vessel has someone that goes overboard and they've got a PLB, the person overboard's got a PLB and they have currently lost visual contact. So they've done the normal procedure. So they're trying to locate the person. They've stopped the vessel. They're trying to spot them. They can't find them. They know the person had a PLB and they want to make contact with the Rescue Coordination Center to check if it's been activated and get a position on the beacon. How can they do that? If the person had AIS, and hopefully they can use that to home in and locate them as they get closer if that's been activated. But how could a vessel contact the Rescue Coordination Center to try and check if a beacon's been activated and get a position? And is that something they can do?
Good question, Neil. So the Search and Rescue Maritime Desk, they can be contacted on a 24-hour helpline if you had access to a satellite phone. And so the number is 1-800-641-792 or 02-6230-6811. Also consider using your marine radio to communicate with the Coast Guard, Water Police or nearby vessels, and communicate your nature of distress and assistance required. If it is an AIS-equipped beacon, the location details will come through the message 14. Otherwise, if the AIS beacon has been activated and a local response has successfully recovered the person or persons involved, then it's important to ensure that you advise the Rescue Coordination Centre so they can stand down any national response that may be in the process of being coordinated.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. That's really helpful. And also, are there any options to update your passage plan within the AMSA system? And are these only checked by when there's a beacon activated, or if you put a passage plan, you know, into your AMSA account where your beacon's registered, is someone monitoring that to make sure you get there safely and things?
Yes, you can add your trip details to your beacon registration, and this information, it's only accessed in the event your beacon is detected, and this greatly assists the search and rescue officers.
Awesome. So it's sort of, let's say you do a trip and you're heading out to Lord Howe Island or something, you know, 400 or 500 mile passage. There's not someone sort of sitting there monitoring it going, okay, they've logged on and logged off and we can see there safely. But you're just putting the vessel details in there with any useful information so that if a beacon was activated, that when the account is accessed, you can see the passage plan trip, and you just significantly help from a search and rescue effort for the understanding of what the vessel was doing, maybe the number of people on board and that kind of thing. Is that right?
Exactly. And really critical, as you identified, persons on board is of particular interest. That helps them identify the type of asset or size of asset that needs to be tasked.
Brilliant. And I mean, is that something as well, if you had someone that might have quite specific medical assistance requirements, that is that somewhere that they could put that in as well, to just make that clear if it was, is that sort of something that happens, or is that kind of overkill?
Indeed, some people do provide medical guidance as well that can assist with the coordination in the background. So certainly of value.
All right, brilliant. Thank you. Now, in the event of an abandonment with an EPIRB and PLB available, how do you determine which one to use? Like, or do you just activate everything?
Good question. So the circumstances for each distress situation are different. Therefore, you may need to activate the beacon, which is easily accessible at the time. So if you're on board the vessel and you have access to all the beacons, then really priority should be to activate the EPIRB. If you're in the water and become separated from the EPIRB and you have access to only a PLB, then activate the PLB. If you're in a group, then please don't activate more than two beacons. If the group separates, activate a beacon in each group. If individuals drift apart, activate beacons fitted to each person.
So with the don't activate more than two beacons, is that in terms of maintaining battery life, or is that something where it kind of confuses the signal to have too many beacons in the same area? Just, I suppose, more for an understanding for the listener. Why should they not activate more than two beacons at any one time?
It's really not necessary to activate more than two beacons, because we've received the distress alert messages for two beacons, and we know that a distress situation is underway and some assistance is required. So we will commence the coordination response accordingly. And the idea is, if you've got multiple beacons, it's about conserving some of those beacons in case you're finding yourselves in that situation for an extended period of time. And that could be derived based on the location of your distress. So the more remote, then the transmission period required may be required to be longer.
Brilliant. Thank you. Really helpful. Now, carrying on with safety equipment. So is it a good idea to carry expired safety equipment such as beacons as a backup, or would you suggest that, you know, once they're expired and maybe the registration's no longer up to date, etc., that they're disposed of properly and removed from the vessel?
No, you shouldn't rely on expired safety equipment, particularly in a distress situation, as it may not function correctly. So please ensure that you either service or safely dispose of your expired safety equipment.
Brilliant, thank you. And then finally, so in a distress situation, should you indicate if an EPIRB and or PLB has been activated as part of your voice distress message?
So the guidance that we provide is that two-way communication by radio or satellite phone is the most effective means of communication when in a distress situation and should be attempted first. So this enables the instant confirmation that the call has been received, ability to communicate position, nature of distress, required assistance. Then we can adequately scale response assets according to the required assistance and enables the ability to provide updates on the situation and also receive advice until help arrives. So if two-way communication is not available, then a distress beacon should be activated in situations of grave and imminent danger. This equates to when you are feeling or facing a life-threatening situation. This is a personal decision that is different to everybody. In some instances, activation of a distress beacon whilst two-way communication is established may be requested to assist with confirming the location details for response assets and resources.
That's fantastic. I don't think that could be any clearer. Well, thank you very much, Linda. You've given us some amazing insights into the beacons and, you know, the advances in technology and how to make sure that people are setting them up properly. And, you know, as a key headline, if you haven't logged into your account and checked the beacon update recently, just take a few minutes, go back and log in, make sure that your emergency contacts are up to date, that your emergency contacts know they're your emergency contacts. And, you know, if you are doing any passages, be aware of that functionality that you can put in your trip details and crew details in there, because you will make it a lot easier for the RCC in the event that a beacon is activated, that they are a lot more knowledgeable about what you're doing and how they can provide help. So, Linda, thank you very much for joining us today and sharing some of your wealth of knowledge with our listeners.
Thanks, Neil. It's been a pleasure.